AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
Hey, what's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays? Decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Hello and welcome. It's another Books of the Year podcast from your friends at Books of the Year, which is a podcast. Matt is here with his coffee and his glasses case.
Yes, that I never wear.
Why don't you wear your glasses?
Well, I should wear my glasses, obviously, because I went for an eye test a couple of years ago and was told you need glasses, and I beg to differ. But I think...
You argued with the optician.
Yes, I think you pointed out it's literally her job, so she probably knows better than you.
Yes.
But I don't really need them normally. When I'm reading stuff on my phone that's really, really, really small type, then...
So they're just on the table in case?
Just in case there is something I need to refer to, and then I'm totally prepared.
Right.
But normally, obviously, far too vain to wear glasses.
My goodness me. Okay, an interesting insight into the world of Matt Williams. Email from Joelle Braithwaite. Jodi Pico, by the way, is our guest. Mm. She'll be on shortly. Joelle Braithwaite says, Simon and Matt, I was listening to your episode with Ragnar Jonasson recently, and the initial discussion about working in cafes reminded me of a chat I had with my local cafe owner.
Oh, right.
They have a two-hour limit for working in the cafe, which I think is fair. When they were in smaller premises, they had to ban laptops altogether, as they had a guy who'd take up two tables with two laptops and buy one coffee in about 4 hours. I've seen similar timing rules in other cafes in North Leeds, which is where I'm based. It's pretty off-putting to enter a place and see all the tables are taken up by single patrons with laptops, when all I want to do is drink coffee while reading my book, which soon will have to be Death at the Sanatorium, which was Ragnar Jonasson's book he was in to talk about. Anyway, just my two penny worth. Love the show, Joel Braithwaite. I think it is completely fair. If people didn't take the mickey, it wouldn't be necessary. Though I seem to recall J.K. Rowling saying that she would buy like one coffee and sit all day in a cafe in Edinburgh. But I think 2 hours per coffee seems...
It's almost like, I wonder whether if you've got a laptop that you should, you know, there certainly should be a sort of unwritten social rule that not only are you buying coffee, you're buying a few cakes, and whether you eat them or not doesn't matter. That should not, if it's not a written rule now, it should be one that when you go in, you should be buying loads of stuff, whether you're going to eat and drink them or not. If you're going to use a laptop at that table and take up that table for more than an hour, then I think it's only fair.
Yeah, or pay for the Wi-Fi, I suppose.
Yeah. Pay for the Wi-Fi, quite right. Loads of people have been loving our chat with Ben McIntyre. Bits Thought Blade says, a fantastic author and always a fantastic chat with you two. And I Am Tim Not Andy Esquire says...
Hang on, is that...
I Am Tim, Not Andy Esquire. I'm trying
to work
out...
That's their name.
I Am Tim, Not Andy Esquire.
Okay, well, why would we even think he's Andy?
I'm going to say his surname is McNabb or something like that. So I'm Tim, not... Anyway. Says, after listening to the latest Books of the Year with Ben McIntyre, I just needed to know more about Hector. Hector the Corrector, as I believe you called him. As indeed the SAS called him.
Yes.
So I've gone and got myself a copy of The Siege. That's from Colin Udall on Twitter. Oh, no, it's not. This is you talking about Colin Udall.
I am Tim, not Andy.
Yeah.
Yeah, Hector the Corrector was one of the key guys, wasn't he?
He's the one that comes up with the plan, I think, isn't he?
Yes.
Yeah.
And was quite severe.
Yes.
If you're going to have a name like Hector, you're going to have to take what's coming your way, basically. Yeah. And Colin Udall says, can I please recommend The Silence in Between by Josie Ferguson? This was recommended by Susie Dent on says there are another books podcast.
There can't be any other books podcast, right. I don't think so. No.
You must be mistaken.
Yeah.
Anyway, it sounded so good, I had to get it. Having just finished it, I can tell you it's a must read. Tragic, devastating, yet ultimately triumphant. Spoiler. the issue, anyway, Colin says, I loved it, think you will too. Do I want to go through tragedy and devastation just to get to the triumphant?
As you've said before, there's an awful lot of Shawshank before the redemption. Do I really want to go through all of that again?
I mean, I suppose it makes the redemption all the more enjoyable,
the
fact you've had the Shawshank.
But
I suppose I might pick up the silence in between and thinking, yes, okay, tragic, yes, oh, that's devastating. But
yes.
Maybe the triumph is on the last page or something.
Well,
I want more triumph.
Yeah, a bit more triumph. I always like a little bit more triumph at the end of those books, yeah.
If you'd like to get in touch, you can email at any time, booksoftheyear@yahoo.com. We're on Instagram and Threads at Pick Any Page. The Wreckage of Twitter, you can contact us there, Books of the Year. Are we not on Blue Sky?
I don't think we are on Blue Sky, but you are on Blue Sky. Is everything still lovely on Blue Sky? Is it like the first days of Twitter where it was...
It's getting bigger and hotter.
Is it really?
Yes.
Maybe I need to get on Blue Sky. Anyone can go on now. It's not invitation only.
No,
like
that
it's
is
not
correct.
A gentleman's club like it was at the beginning. No, right.
That's absolutely true. They'll accept even you.
Even me will get in with my glasses.
Okay. So, yes, get in touch. Booksoftheyear@yahoo.com. Pick any page, Instagram and Threads. Look out for us on Blue Sky.
Soon.
I mean, I'm there, but who knows. And you can tweet us at Books of the Year. Anyway, international best-selling author on the way. Yes, and that international best-selling author is none other than Jodi Picou. Hello, Jodi. How are you? Very nice to see you again.
It's so fun to be here. Thanks for having me back.
And yes, it was 18 months, couple of years maybe?
It was 2 years.
Two years almost.
This is
the last one. And how have you been?
I've been good. Thank you for asking.
Head down?
Yeah, head down, working hard, all that.
And has this book taken all that time, or have you been working on this for longer?
No, actually, this book has taken about half that time. The other half of the time, I'm working on theater projects.
Oh, well, if there's time, we'll get into your theater projects.
Yeah.
Jodi's book is called By Any Other Name. Matt will now describe the flowery cover.
Yes, and the flowery cover works on at least two levels, which we're going to get into as we talk about the book. But basically what you're going to see is a lot of red roses, Rose by Any Other Name, taking up most of the front cover. But those roses are obscuring a woman's face almost being hidden by the roses, working on that level. Jodi Picou. Picou's name in bold at the top, By Any Other Name in white, and Jojo Moyes says, a gripping, astonishing and heartrending story, the number one bestseller, right at the top.
There you go. That's the whole cover. We don't really need to speak to Jodi because that's all you need
to know. All right, goodbye. Lovely. Thank you.
And that eye follows you around the room.
Yes.
Basically. Yeah.
Because
the first thing you see are the roses and then you see the eye and you go, okay. So we have two stories to follow. One sort of in the present day, but starting in 2013 with Melina, and the other in 1581 starring Emilia. So introduce us to your characters in your latest book.
Sure. So in 1581, Emilia Bassano is a real-life historical figure who is a female playwright and cannot get her work in front of the public because she is a female playwright in Elizabethan England. So she pays a man for the use of his name, and that man happens to be William Shakespeare. And then in 2024, you meet Melina Green, who is her fictional fictional descendant. She has written a play about her ancestor, Emilia. She, too, is a female playwright. But she can't get any traction because Broadway is a very male-dominated world. And so the question is whether she, like her ancestor, will have to write herself out of history in order to see her work on a stage.
Where did the spark of this book come from?
So I was an English major in college. I loved Shakespeare, like many other English majors. What really what really blew me away were the female characters, the Portias and Rosalinds and Beatrice and Kate, and the three-dimensionality of the women, which nobody else seemed to be writing at the time. And I had a professor who spent 5 minutes of a lecture saying, you know, there's a question about whether Shakespeare wrote all of his works. And like every other English major, I just dismissed it. Mm. And then very recently, I was reading an article in The Atlantic by a woman named Elizabeth Winkler called Was Shakespeare a Woman? And in it, she mentioned a fact that just stopped me in my tracks, which is that Shakespeare had two daughters that survived infancy, and he did not teach either of them to read or write. They signed with a mark. And I was like, oh, no, no, no. There is no way that the guy who created those amazing characters wouldn't have taught his own girls how to read and write. And that made me very interested in what this woman had to say in the article. She was the first to hold up Emilia Bassano as a potential authorship candidate for the Shakespearean plays. I had never heard of Emilia, and I wound up doing this deep historical dive into who she was and learning about her life. And almost seamlessly, Emilia's life slots into all the places that for years academics have twisted themselves in knots trying to explain the gaps in Shakespeare's life. Like, without even trying, Emilia just fits them.
So what do we know? So in your character, Emilia Bassano, who, if you want to look her up, she's got a Wikipedia page, but she's Emilia Lanier.
That's her married name, yes.
Right, okay. So you have created an extraordinary character. How much of that do we absolutely know for certain, and how much have you enjoyed creating for us?
So everything about her character that is historically available is part of this story. What we know about Emilia is that she came from a family that lived in Bassano del Grappa, Italy. They were remarkable musicians. They played the recorder. Henry VIII came over and heard them playing and brought them back to be the recorder consort to the king. When he died, they became the recorder consort to Queen Elizabeth. They were Jewish, and they had to hide their faith when they got to England, so they were all hidden Jews. And when Emilia was seven, her dad died, mom moved away, and so she wound up as the ward of the Countess of Kent. And the Countess of Kent was remarkable because she gave Emilia a full legal and classical education, which would have been rare for a noble daughter, much less some commoner girl, but definitely would have sparked Emilia's intelligence and mind. When Emilia was 12, the Countess got remarried, and she moved to the Netherlands. Emilia was not allowed to go. So Emilia wound up living for a summer with this Countess's brother, a man named Peregrine Bardi, who was a baron and was the ambassador to Denmark. And he did indeed go on a diplomatic mission to Denmark that summer, where he met the king and queen of Denmark. He had dinner with Tycho Brahe, the famous astronomer whose supernova is the very first scene in Hamlet, and Tycho Brahe's relatives, who just happened to be named Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, yeah. Right? You know, and then when the next year came around and Emilia was 13, she was given to the Lord Chamberlain of England to become his mistress. He was 56 at the time. He was in charge of all theater. So for the 10 years that she lived with him, she absolutely would have met every playwright, every actor, theater owner, producer in England, would have gone to rehearsals with him, would have gone to opening nights. And then when she's 23 years old, she gets pregnant. She cannot be a pregnant mistress in that house, so she gets kicked out, married off to Alfonso Lanier, who is her cousin, terrible human being who squanders all the money that has been settled on her to keep her comfortable for life. So she's 23. She has a baby, she has a husband she hates, and she has to somehow keep her family afloat. And we don't hear about her for 20 years, when suddenly she becomes the first published female poet in all of England ever. And people should know her name for that alone, mm-hmm. whether or not you believe she had anything to do with Shakespeare, but nobody has heard of her. You know, and I believe that writers don't just pop up and suddenly as women get published in their 40s. She was clearly writing before that. I just happen to believe she was doing it under someone else's name. So in writing the story, those are the high marks of her life that we have. They all come from one primary source document. It is a diary by Simon Forman, who is this astrologer / hack doctor she visited at one point, who kept meticulous notes, including how he tried to sleep with her and she said no multiple times. And that right. Lovely. It's in the Ashmolean. And you can go and read it too. And to create her character, I basically had to string a line between those historical events and figure out how one led to the other.
So the reason I particularly like the book is because as you've already alluded to, there is this sort of story that we have that's set in the modern day, where still we have female writers who can't get their work produced on Broadway, and so that female writer ends up having to submit her work with a male name or with a sort of androgynous name, so that it's not clear that it's from a woman. The idea that Shakespeare didn't write his works is, I remember there was a movie not so long ago, I think Anonymous, which basically, I can't remember who they said, it was either De Vere or Earl of Oxford.
Probably,
or someone like that, they were responsible. I'd not heard the Emilia Bassano story before. Was she, you've mentioned that your sort of, the spark for you was that Atlantic article.
Yeah.
I'm guessing that was the first time that you came across Emilia's name.
Right.
What is it? I mean, I can see why it works in the book, but what is it about Emilia being the possible true author of Shakespeare's works? What is it about her claim that stands out for you?
So, first of all, let me back up and say you're right. The authorship controversy is not new by any means. And most of us who think that it's possible that Shakespeare didn't write everything, we're called crackpots and conspiracy theorists. What is new is the idea that maybe women were potential authorship candidates. And I personally believe that it wasn't Emilia who wrote all the plays. I think there was a group of people who wrote them. I liken it to James Patterson now with his little stable of authors all writing.
Yeah.
You know, but I think that Oxford was probably the ringleader. And everyone who was writing had a reason for not having their name in front of the public. And Amelia's obviously was because she was a woman. The reason I think Emilia has a claim to this is because I got to a point in doing the research where it just couldn't all be coincidence anymore. And I'll give you one very simple example. Let's look at Othello. Right? Othello actually comes from a short story that was written by an Italian named Cinthio. It was not translated until the 1700s from the original Italian, and then it was translated into French, not even English. Both Italian and French are languages that Shakespeare did not read or speak. It's important to say that. When it first came out, and when Othello came out, people were wondering where the name Othello came from, because the only named character in the Cinthio story is Desdemona. When you read Othello, there's a really interesting little pair of lines that are spoken by Iago, and the villain in the story is talking about revenge, and he uses these metaphors for a monkey, a goat, and the door of truth, which is, okay, it's a weird group of metaphors. But it becomes stranger when you know that in the town of Bassano del Grappa, Italy, where all of Emilia's family came from, there's a big square with a very famous fresco that has in it a monkey, a goat, and a woman representing truth between two arched doors. Also in that main square were two apothecaries at the time. One shop was called The Moor, which ties right into the tragedy of Othello, The Moor of Venice. The other apothecary shop was run by a man named Otello.
Okay.
But wait, I'm not done yet. Right. Then there are two versions of Othello. The first was published in the first quarto. A few years later, a revised version was published in the first folio with the rest of the Shakespearean works. In the first quarto, and between the first quarto and the first folio, something significant happened. Shakespeare died. And yet, in the later version, there are roughly 160 odd lines that were added. We know Shakespeare didn't write them. How do we know this? He's literally dead. So it's not him. It's got to be someone else. The lines are almost exclusively given to the character of Desdemona's servant in a soliloquy that is widely considered the first feminist soliloquy in all of theatrical literature. And it talks about how women have the same flaws and fears as men and the same need for revenge, and how men teach it to us. And that should terrify by men. And the name of the servant who speaks all this, of course, is Emilia. And so, you know, again, that's one example. And then you've got Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. Then you've got the fact that there's, in all of Shakespeare's plays, only once is the name of the age of a heroine named. And it's three times in Romeo and Juliet 13, that, and it's always about whether Juliet is ready for a sexual relationship. That is the exact age that Emilia was when she was given to the Lord Chamberlain to be his mistress. add to that things like feminist readings now of Hamlet and why Ophelia was mad. A lot of feminist Shakespearean scholars believe, and there's lots of textual evidence for this, that Hamlet was sleeping with her, got her pregnant, and then got so busy with his revenge scheme that she's left with a baby and she doesn't know what to do because no one is helping her with this, not Gertrude, not her dad, not her brother, certainly not Hamlet. And so what does she do? She kills herself. And in that beautiful scene where she's giving out all those flowers, she holds back only one for herself, and it's rue, which was used at the time to abort babies. Now, when you read that through the eyes of a woman creating it, especially a woman who was booted out of a house because she got pregnant and was unmarried, it looks very different, doesn't it?
Yes.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
You mentioned, and Matt mentioned, the fact that, you know, the people have been around for a while saying, obviously for a long time, saying that Shakespeare is not responsible for all or most or some of his work. And a lot of the people who get into the press arguing those cases, sometimes it's felt like snobbery.
Yes.
That it's basically been, how can a common person like Shakespeare come up with this genius? And I've always thought, shut up. You know,
right.
Genius comes from,
sure,
from who knows where.
Right.
Your book is the first time that I've actually thought this all works. And the idea of William Shakespeare representing a bunch of people. Maybe he did write some of it, but maybe it's like a brand name.
Yes, exactly.
Like a cooperative.
Yes.
And the fact that in the printed book that Emilia Lanier did come up with, which the translation is "Hail God, King of the Jews."
Yes.
You make a point of saying that all the dedications are
women.
Are all to women.
Yes.
So that kind of ties in. And I think anyone who reads this book and the extensive author notes at the end will think that you're onto something.
You know, it's what's interesting to me, it is interesting that you point that out, that, you know, a lot has been made about the fact that there is snobbery involved in thinking that Shakespeare, who didn't go to university and may not even have gone to grammar school, could not have come up with all this.
Yeah, it has to be an aristocrat of some kind.
Right. Well, Amelia wasn't one, first of all. But more to the point, tell me how Shakespeare died without owning a single book. Because he would have had to do extensive research to know all these things that were not part of his life. And there weren't lending libraries around at the time. So how is he coming up with all this stuff, right? You know, we know he's not speaking certain languages. We know he hasn't been to these places. We know that he doesn't have a legal education. We know that he wasn't in the inner workings of court. All of those things are things that happen in Shakespearean plays. I totally buy that he could have educated himself, but there should be some evidence of that when he dies because, you know, if he could manage to give away a few pence to his friends to make rings for himself to be remembered, I'm sure he literally gave away everything in that will. So I don't understand how there wasn't a single book there. I don't understand how his son-in-law, who was a physician, would have written extensively about all of the business deals that he did with his father-in-law. And never happened to mention that his father-in-law wrote a play. You know, I mean, I don't understand how when Shakespeare died, although his name as a playwright was the most well-known at the time, not a single other living playwright said anything about what a great loss to literature this was. There's too many holes. There are too many gaps. And, you know, like there's a famous Shakespearean scholar who was talking about the fact that Aeschylus's ideas are also in the Shakespearean plays. And admittedly, Shakespeare did not read ancient Greek. And this just proves, he said, that great minds come up with the same great ideas. And I was like, yeah, or maybe it proves that someone who could read ancient Greek wrote those plays. You know, there's always an easier explanation. So I do think that the idea of having a woman involved as a potential author candidate, and I think there were more than just Amelia, for the record, that seems to set people off even more, make them even angrier. And in this case, I really do believe that absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. We have not heard about female author candidates as potentials for the Shakespearean plays because we just don't have writing from women. And that's because the men who were writing down history didn't think it was important enough to preserve. And yet we are seeing a lot of Shakespearean scholars who are women now who are finding these authored notes by women who were about to have babies. When you were having a baby, you would write a letter to your unborn child to impart the knowledge that you thought you weren't going to be around to give them because you expected to die. You literally bought your shroud when you went into confinement. And if the baby survived, of course, most people burn those letters because it was really bad luck. But what we know from the few they're finding is that women wrote, women had very deep and complex feelings, and women used writing to record their wisdom. You know, that's very interesting. It's just, it hasn't been explored before because we haven't had enough people looking into that particular gap.
So, Jodie, I have a question, and I'm going to, in order to build up the courage to ask this question, Jenny, I'm going to force you to come on a journey with
me.
So, when I was doing my A-levels, I had a really, really good English lit teacher English and French, those two teachers made me who I am. And this English lit teacher, we did Macbeth and we did Richard II. Richard II is my favourite Shakespearean play. And whenever it's being played, I force my wife to come along with me because I really love it. And basically, he started by telling the class, he said, This is the premise of this play, before we read a word, is that you've got Richard II, who is wholly unsuited to rule. He's not a good king. The people around him know that. He knows that. He's not a good king. However, he has been appointed by God. And everyone in that room believes he's been appointed by God. Could God have made a mistake? Mm. That's the premise. And everyone in that room, everyone in that classroom was like, wow, what a premise. Could God have made a mistake? And I've carried that with me for years afterwards. And that is the reason why I love that play. And we're getting to my question. I'm building up the courage, Jodie.
Scary question.
In your book, it obviously matters that Amelia, the theory that Amelia could be the true author, because she's yet another woman who has seen her ideas, her work, stolen by a man. And we've seen that through centuries. My question is,
here we go.
Does it matter if Shakespeare wasn't the author? I get the Amelia side. I get the, if it was actually a woman, then absolutely it matters. But let's posit the idea that maybe it was a group of people. That's not going to change my relationship with Richard II. I'm still going to love that play. It doesn't matter who wrote it to me. Tell me why it does matter.
Okay, but first I really want to stage Richard II now, but I want him to look like Donald Trump.
Well, there you go. Without the self-awareness. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So I'm going to take you on a journey. Okay.
So Donald Trump, God did make a mistake. If God had anything
Simon,
to do with it.
Yes, you're right. Yeah. Okay. I am going to tell you about my own theatrical experience because for the past 10 years, I've been working in the Broadway world and writing librettos. The first libretto that I wrote was an adaptation of a book that I co-wrote with my daughter called Between the Lines. It is a young girl's coming-of-age story. I have a co-librettist who is a man who's a very good friend of mine. And when we worked on this for 8 years, when it finally was about to come out in 2022 off-Broadway, our producer said, I don't think your name, Jodie, should be on the program as a co-librettist because she was afraid people would see the show as a vanity project because I had written the original source material. And I said, okay, if that's the only way we're going to cross the finish line, absolutely. And I did make that decision. And it is worth pointing out that Shakespeare, I don't believe that he stole Amelia's ideas. I believe that she paid him for the use of his name. So there is a slight difference there. So again, I, like Amelia, made a very calculated choice and decision to omit my own name so that my work could be on stage. When the show finally closed in a few months later, my co-librettist went to his lawyer and said, this is not right. It's not fair. She absolutely wrote this show and made sure that my names were on all the materials now that are given out to, now it's being licensed, so it's for theaters and schools or anyone who wants to perform it. And when you get that packet, there I am as one of the co-librettists. And I got to tell you, it feels a lot better. You know, when you do the work, it's easy to think you can separate the art from the artist. But when you're in that situation, suddenly credit matters a little. It does actually make you feel like you've gotten your just rewards when you are credited for the work, the hard work that you have done and the trouble that you've taken to create a piece of art. And in fact, Melina in this book starts off by thinking, no, it's okay. You can separate art and artist. And I would like to believe by the end of the book, she thinks differently. What I do think is interesting about your question, though, is it does beg the question, why are all these Stratfordians so rigid in their thinking? Why is it so important to them that Shakespeare wrote every word himself? It will not change the plays. It will not change our love of the plays. All we are suggesting is that if after 400 years, there might be evidence that it's worth looking at this from a different angle, that we might not have given credit where it's due, maybe isn't it time to do so?
Was there any part of you that thought of basing the whole book in the 16th century? That, so you were just talking about Melina, so that's the 21st century bit. So it seems to me you had two, you could have written a non, there's enough here to write a nonfiction book.
Yeah.
Here's the story of Emilia. That's what we're going to do. Nonfiction, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
That's one option. Another option would be to just base it in the 1500s.
Right.
And the third option is the one that you've gone for. Was there any debate in your mind about that?
Yeah, especially because unlike my other books, this is the first book that I didn't write in the order in which you read it. Usually if I'm flipping back and forth in timelines or narrative voices, I write it exactly the way you read it. What, chapter one, then chapter two, then chapter three. But it was so hard for me holding all the history, it almost felt like casting a magical spell to create the world of Elizabethan England in a way that people could identify and relate to it, and to have, the narrative arc for Emilia. It was juggling too much for me to be able to switch back and forth between past and present. So I wrote the entire section of Emilia's story, and then I wrote the entire section of Melina's story, and then I cut them together. But I've never written like that before. And when I finished the historical part, I was like, well, this is certainly long enough to be its own book. Should it be? And in fact, my husband, who is a big historian himself, is like, why is it this just the book? This is fine. But I really wanted to draw a direct link between how things have changed for women in 400 years and how they have not. And I think it's very easy when you write historical fiction for a reader to dismiss it as, well, yes, but that was the past. And my point is, it is also still the present.
The last time you were on, Jodie, you talked to us about how some of your books had been, taken out of libraries. Banned. Banned is the word. Because they covered certain topics.
Yeah.
And there were certain states that didn't want children to read those books. And you mention in your author's notes at the back end of this that you are expecting some antagonism from this book. I wonder whether, because I don't know what kind of antagonism you've had previously in this country, if any, but I wonder, are you expecting more antagonism? Because, bluntly, Shakespeare is a British icon.
He's a religion.
Over here. And you've already said, you know, there are people in Stratford whose literal, their well-being, their income depends on Shakespeare being the writer of all of those plays. Is the antagonism likely to come from this country this time as a result of this work?
I have had a little bit, tiny bit of pushback in America, where I had a couple of professors emeriti write me, very clear from their emails that they had not read the book, but still decided I was a conspiracy theorist.
Good work. Yes. Well done.
Right. Yeah, yeah. After I was here in May, I did an event at the Hay Festival. The book wasn't even available yet. It hadn't been printed. And there were a couple of fusty old men who decided to make their opinions known on blogs and in media, because I was clearly wrong, although, again, they had not read the book. And tomorrow night, I'm doing an event in Stratford. So let's see. 100%. That literally was the first place I asked to go on book tour, because, you know, when you're going to take on the beast, you go right into its den. And I'm excited. I can't wait to have pushback, because, you know, it really does come down to that. For anyone who says to me, how could you possibly think Emilia Bassano had anything to do with these plays? My response has to be, why is it so important to you that she doesn't? And I'm still waiting for one of these old white men to answer that question for me.
There's like an addendum to your the author's note when you talk about some miniatures you found, which delivers extraordinary kind of photographic evidence. You just want to tell us about it's the Earl of Southampton.
Yes, I have to tell you, this is my favorite thing to talk about. This has never happened to me in the history of all of my career. But, you know, you talked about what is fact and what is fiction in this book. And I said, everything does come from a primary source. Amelia had a really rough life. And I did want to give her a little bit of joy. And while I was pouring through the primary sources, there was a time in Amelia's life when she was in her 50s, when her terrible husband finally died, and she wound up taking her brother-in-law to court because he was getting money that she was owed as a widow. And at the end of this trial, out of nowhere, the Earl of Southampton comes swanning in and he says, "Hey, I'm not the magistrate here, but if I was, I would rule in her favor." And when I saw that, I was like, what just happened? Because there is no world in which the very titled, very wealthy, very well-known Earl of Southampton would ever have interceded in a commoner's trial. It just would not have happened. So I said to myself, all right, did they know each other? And I realized that the 10 years that Amelia was at court, you know, she absolutely would have crossed paths with him. Court was very tiny, very incestuous. They all moved around together. And, you know, she's the mistress of a 56-year-old guy, and Southampton was apparently quite good-looking for the time and was 3.5 years younger than her. And who knows, you know, maybe she decided to have a little fun on the side. So I decided I was going to write this doomed love into the book and give her a little bit of fun. And I finished the entire book, come to London for a theater project, and I made an appointment at the Victoria and Albert with the archivist because the miniature that is widely assumed to be Amelia Bassano is in their archives. It's painted by Nicholas Hilliard, very famous miniature portraitist of the time. And they take out Amelia for me, and I'm holding her, which was like mind-blowing. I'm holding a miniature she would have held. Oh, my God. But my eye keeps getting drawn to the miniature in the case next to hers. And it is a portrait of this guy with long, curly red hair. He is on a black field instead of a typical blue one, which Hilliard tended to paint. He has his hand covering his heart. And I said to the archivist, "So who's this guy?" And they said, "Oh, that's an unknown man." And they told me that the black and the hand over the heart would have definitely been the decision of the man sitting for the portrait to signify despair. It was like a little puzzle you put into your portrait so people knew you better. They told me the painting was on the back of the Six of Hearts, which in kind of early Elizabethan tarot called cartomancy means the soulmate card. It is the person you're meant to be with that you can't be with because of fate. And they reiterated they did not know who had sat for this particular portrait. And I said, well, I think I might know. And I pulled up on my phone an accredited portrait of the Earl of Southampton from 4 years later, after that miniature was painted. It, too, had been painted by Nicholas Hilliard. And you can still see, you know, this long, beautiful red hair, the same features, a lacy collar, just like the one he was wearing. And this one had been painted on the Three of Hearts, which signifies someone has entered our relationship that's going to break it apart. In my book in 1594, I have a scene where Amelia is beaten so badly by her husband, she literally crawls to Southampton. And so I show this to the archivists, and their jaws drop, and they're like, what? We have to learn more about this. This is amazing. So I went home saying, well, I have to do more research. And I found a portrait by John de Kritz, which was painted of Southampton the same year as that miniature, and I sent it to them. And you can absolutely see, and this is in the back of the book, the same features, the thin eyebrows, the delicacy of his facial bones. They look very, very similar. And the archivist wound up sending me back a 30-page document saying at the end of it, you know, yes, we actually believe this could very well be Southampton. So for 250 years, Amelia and Southampton have been cuddled up together in a box in the V&A. And I like to think that maybe I wrote that into existence.
This and other extraordinary stories are in Jodi Picoult's new book, By Any Other Name. Jodi, it's always a pleasure and an adventure when a new Jodi Picoult book comes along. I imagine you've already finished the next one.
I have not, but I do know what I'm writing about.
What are you writing about?
So it's going to come out in 2026. It is the 25th anniversary of 9/11. And I wanted to write about that. And there was an old Tumblr blog called Post Secret. Did you know it? No?
Don't think so.
Okay.
Not really on Tumblr. So
okay,
go on.
Well, wait. It became a website and then it became an Instagram handle. So, you know. But Post Secret, you could send a postcard anonymously to people and it would have your deepest, darkest secret. And then they would be anonymously published, basically. And they could be anything from, you know, I walk around naked all weekend when I'm not at work to my husband doesn't know our third child is not his. Anything in between. Mm-hmm. So once I read a Post Secret post that said, everyone who knew me before 9/11 thinks that I'm dead. And that's my book.
Okay. Well,
that'll do.
Yep.
I'm hooked. There's your premise.
I'll buy that. Thank you very much. But for the meantime, before we get to that point, Jodie's book is by any other name. There'll be more with Jodie with our Q&A podcast, which will land with you in the next few days. For the moment, Jodie, thank you very much.
My pleasure.